Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, the essential podcast for middle market business owners, key stakeholders, and the advisors who guide them. I'm Josh Pottinger and joined by my co-host, Jason Chirogiannis. Together, we lead ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team at UBS here in Austin, Texas. Now, over the course of almost 30 years, we've built a vibrant community and have curated a suite of resources tailored for your success, from insightful white papers and cutting-edge research to exclusive in-person events and expert-led podcasts. We are here to provide the tools that you need. Now, if you're considering an exit, this is likely the most significant financial decision of your life, and typically, you only have one chance to get it right. So our mission is clear: to arm you with the knowledge to enhance the value of your business, navigate a successful sale, and of course, optimize your post-exit financial outcomes. Now with that, let's dive in and unlock the strategies that will prepare you for a prosperous future. Hello, everyone. It's Josh Pottinger here, and I'm excited about episode number 25 of our Lightning in a Bottle podcast series. And today I'm excited to have our guest, Chris Cooley, on the line here. Chris, are you there?
I am here. Good to be here.
Good deal. Well, Chris, thanks for joining me this morning. So to the listeners out there, our topic of this podcast episode is going to be about key man insurance and buy-sell agreements. So these are two critical components to running a well-oiled business machine, especially if you have some folks there at the company that are really important to the profitability and sustainability of the company. And then if you have some partners, a buy-sell agreement is always a good thing to have. So when it comes to these two issues, I find in my conversations out there, there can be some confusion in terms of like what it is, why it's important. So before we dive into that, I wanted to share a little bit about Chris here. Chris was originally born in Seattle, Washington, but early on moved over to Atlanta, Georgia, and Chris began his professional career more than 30 years ago. So you've got a few more years than I do. But Chris and I have gotten to know each other very well over the years, and Chris is truly a trusted advisor in this space. He's somebody that we always go to for any of our more complex deals. He shoots straight, very thorough, very knowledgeable. And I thought, if anyone I want to have on this podcast to talk about this stuff, it's going to be Chris. So he's got a good, deep understanding of complex insurance, estate planning, wealth transfer techniques that has enabled him to serve families and executives and business owners and the exclusive clients of ours across the country. And most recently, Chris established his own brokerage firm, Prosperity Life Advisory Group, where they provide a concierge-style experience to their clients. So Chris is married to Shelley. They reside in Franklin, Tennessee with all the movie stars. He's got a couple of children, Evan and Sarah. He's a big-time soccer player, and he's still playing. Good for you, Chris. Chris, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks again. And I mean, I don't know about big-time soccer player. I mean, I'm still playing, but maybe not as good as I was 30 years ago when I started this business.
How's the Achilles heel and the hammies? Are they doing all right?
In any given day, you never know, but today they feel good.
Yeah, good deal. Okay. All right, well, good. Well, let's go ahead and let's get into it. Let's just talk about first, what is key man and buy-sell and a buy-sell agreement? Give us a high-level overview.
That's definitely a great place to start, because you mentioned that sometimes there's some confusion in this area, and we often receive phone calls from advisors or their clients alike, and they tend to use the key person or key man terminology sort of interchangeably with a buy-sell agreement. And really, they are two distinctly different items, and that's important to know. So when you talk about a buy-sell agreement, you are truly talking about a legally binding contract between business owners outlining how that business or their business interest is going to be handled in the event of a death or a disability, or in the event they just depart, they don't want to be there any longer. It's important to keep in mind that this is an actual legally binding contract that you've sat down with an attorney, had drafted, and it's going to govern how things are going to take place in the event there's a disagreement, somebody wants to go, or in the event somebody unexpectedly passes away and now their share of the business has to be dealt with on behalf of the family. Completely separate from that, a key person arrangement is really not a legally binding arrangement, but it's really focused more on the insurance aspect of purchasing an insurance contract on an employee. And when I say purchasing, the business will be purchasing this contract on the employee to help in the event that something happens to this employee. And this is not really departure. We're talking about a death or a disability of that key person because they are driving revenue. They have knowledge that others simply don't have within the company to keep it running and keep it running profitably. So the key person is really anybody you can identify that would result in a significant operational loss, potentially, if they weren't there. And you're using insurance to simply bridge some time to find another key person to replace that person in the event they're no longer there at the company.
So one thing I'm curious about is sizing something like this, but I want to hold off on that for right now. What's the most sort of difficult aspect of initiating this sort of conversation with owners in the early stages? And what do you see as sort of the largest misconceptions when starting to engage in this sort of discussion?
Yeah, and in our world, the most difficult aspect, I think, is probably the same thing, Josh, for you and your team, which is getting a business owner who is really getting a business off the ground and doing nothing else 80 hours a week to actually take the time to focus on that conversation, to have that conversation, or frankly, even in some cases, to recognize at that point that it's an issue. So no doubt about it, is getting their attention with something like this can be difficult because everything else that they're doing is simply more important at that particular moment in time. And in terms of maybe the largest misconceptions, first of all, I think our insurance industry has helped with misconceptions because every small business owner certainly had an insurance individual approach them, and probably more than not, they've had less than a pleasant experience. Somebody trying to sell them something, you know, just because they want to sell them an insurance policy. And that's just not always the right way to go about it. But, you know, our own industry has caused some of that, or I should say a lot of that misconception. But the misconceptions that we do hear outside of that are that they're concerned about it being too costly. They're concerned about it being too time consuming. And that it's just maybe not necessarily something they need to address right at that moment. And it all depends on what stage of the business you're in, but really at any stage where the business starts to have a value to it, whether that value is 100,000 or 100 million, there is a risk there. And it's something that can be addressed without it being costly and without it being time consuming or difficult, as long as you're working with the right person and the right advisors.
So the purpose of buying an insurance policy on a key person is to replace some of that lost revenue and to go and find another person to fall in behind them. Is that right?
In textbook form, yes. You know, we see so many different definitions of key people inside of a business. You know, I think the most obvious one is in a business that is quote unquote selling their product, if you will, you have an individual, and maybe the individual is the one that started the company, who is out there making those connections, clearly driving revenue by acquiring new customers, and they're just an outlier to anybody else in the business. And that revenue, a loss of that revenue stream, if you will, would be somewhat catastrophic. And so that one, I think, is kind of black and white. It's really easy to see that because they're bringing revenue in the door. But there are a lot of key individuals within businesses that aren't necessarily the number one salesperson. They are the one driving strategy. They are the one helping carve a path to the company, if you will. And without them, the business would be just as catastrophically interrupted as it would be to not have your salesperson there. So you mentioned, you know, how to value, and that is a tough part of the market for sure, is how to put a value on that key person. That really just comes down to some conversation, you know, understanding, is this person even replaceable? If they are, what would we have to pay to find another person? How long would it take us? What do we think we'd lose in revenue in the meantime? And really just coming up with an estimate, for lack of a better phrase, that is going to help bridge some time for the company to try and address those issues that occur as a result of that person no longer being there.
So the key man component of this conversation seems like it sort of evolves into that particular key person once the business is established. The buy-sell agreement, that's something that I would imagine needs to happen earlier than later.
It does. And that's not how it works in the real world, because again, business owners are You know, that's at the bottom of the list is sitting down with an attorney and saying, gee, let's work on a buy-sell arrangement here. But business owners are, good business owners are good at managing risk. And so they see risk as obvious things out there in their world that they live in every day. But the risk of my partner and I own this business 50-50, and if he passes away tomorrow, now I'm in business with his spouse.
Right.
Is that what I want? Is that what he would have wanted? How am I supposed to address that? He or she isn't here now to discuss with their surviving spouse how they wanted it to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So those are extremely difficult conversations if, again, myself and my partner haven't already had them, haven't already laid out the guidelines as to how we want to have this dealt with. It can really easily be the end of a business because we don't have an agreement in place that says how it's going to be handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that. One of the first things in our exit planning, when I went through the certification exit planning program, they talk about one of the first phases is to de-risk when we're talking to clients. And so, and they talk about the five D's. I've talked about this on previous episodes, but it's divorce, it's disagreement, disability, distress, and death. And these, well, particularly the buy-sell agreement is going to help knock a few of these things out, and then also the key man as well. So this checks a lot of boxes, actually.
Yeah, it does. You know, again, it's just a matter of that stage of life of the business when they finally sit down and say, wow, this is really an issue. And it's unfortunate it doesn't happen when businesses are younger. But I can tell you that when businesses grow older, it definitely happens. And the reality that hits owners in the face, so to speak, when their business starts to become valued at $20 million or $30 million or $50 million, and they look at that and go, what if my partner died tomorrow? How am I going to pay off his family $25 million for his half of the business? Or do we even have the ability to do that? Or is that what he would want? These are things you don't know without the two people who formed the business brought it to success. You don't know the answers without those two people having set the guidelines, so to speak.
Right. It's funny, I'm like a broken record on this, but you know, an owner of a company, their position in their company is the single largest item on their balance sheet, usually by an order of magnitude. And so why wouldn't you want to de-risk that biggest line item? You know, if you had an art piece that was worth $50 million versus your ownership position in your company worth $50 million, it's like taking that $50 million art piece and throwing it into the garage without anything covering it.
Right.
Right? I mean, you're just putting it at a lot of risk out there to the elements and rain and fire and everything else, right? And so, you know, I think we all know it makes sense, but in reality, it's so difficult to get owners' attention on this. So talking about some of the challenges facing a business owner whose business is growing rapidly, but still kind of in the early stages, like what's your approach there?
These answers are going to start to relate to each other as we sort of work our way through them. But if you've got a growing business or one that has grown rapidly, more often than not, the business has a good amount of value, but the cash flow could still be negative. It could still certainly be very illiquid. Maybe it's not at a stage yet where it's can be sold. And so the question comes in, well, I've got a negative cash flowing business, although it's really growing very well and it's going right down the path we want it to. How are we going to value this? What are the different metrics that if I'm not here tomorrow, what are the metrics that I want you to use with my family when you decide how much you're going to pay them for the value of this business?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's especially in that sort of early-ish stage where there's just not a lot of cash flow and, you know, not a lot of liquidity to the business, that's a really big issue. And so insurance is able to provide some immediate liquidity in those cases where you can come to an agreement as to how you'd like to have the business dealt with. Insurance may be the only source of added liquidity. The last thing you want is to pile more debt onto the surviving shareholder so that he can pay off the spouse of the deceased shareholder. But having that conversation and finding a way to insert that liquidity into the equation is really, really important.
Tons of cases where clients, you know, they're running their company at a negative cash flow because they're piling a bunch more into the company to facilitate that growth and scale up. On the surface, when you value it using your traditional models, it's probably going to detract from the value. But if you stopped that, you know, those one-time capital expenditures and threw that to the bottom line, the answer is a lot different.
Yeah, and it's that way at the insurance carrier as well. You know, when we have a case like that and the owners have decided, hey, we do want to address this. We want to make sure there's liquidity there. Let's go out and acquire some insurance to make sure that this has been addressed. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a dance, if you will, to navigate that conversation with the insurance carrier to say, hey, here's their financials. Here's the negative cash flow. We'd like $10 million worth of insurance to insure the owners for the negative cash flow business that they own. So, you know, real business people in the real world understand that's just how starting a business works. It doesn't have positive cash flow on day one. And at the end of the day, insurance companies understand that as well. But you have to be working with somebody who is advocating on your behalf, helping an underwriter who sits behind the desk all day and just evaluates medical issues and whether or not they want to issue insurance policies on individuals coming in with applications. And we have to educate them on this is what this category of business looks like. Here are other examples of other businesses in this field. Here are studies that show how well this business is doing compared to its peers. So it's a bit more work to get some of those answers and to provide what's needed to the insurance company. But if you have somebody good that you're working with who's experienced in that area, they'll be able to navigate obtaining insurance even on a business that has negative cash flow, as long as other factors are positive.
Right. I guess the math is going to be different whether this is a lifestyle, a type of a company, or if it's a company that's trying to drive enterprise value. Because what we were just kind of talking about is would be more along the lines of a company trying to drive enterprise value, right? Versus a lifestyle company that, as my friend says, they're scraping the table every year, you know, pulling all the cash out to fund their lifestyle. So that, you know, comes to the question of how to replace income for the owner's family, how to assess that.
That really can be tied in with the buy-sell agreement to a certain extent. So insurance companies look for insurable interest. When somebody comes to them and says, I want some insurance, their first question is, okay, well, why do you want it? And there are a multitude of categories. There are, well, I need it for estate planning purposes. I'm going to have a large tax when we pass away because of the size of my estate. Or the most common, I have a family to take care of. So I want to make sure that my wife and children or my husband and children are protected. Or again, we're talking about funding, obviously, for buy-sell purposes. So they will actually look at each category and based on financial information that we provide, they'll say, okay, well, under the buy-sell category, they could qualify for X dollars of insurance. Under estate planning, they could qualify for X. Under income replacement, they could qualify for X. So those conversations certainly are intermingled when we're talking about buy-sell, because sometimes today's value of the business may not really be enough to support the family, and there just may be excess coverage that is necessary to support the income needs, college needs, and so forth for the family. And that's just part of having a good consultation, making sure that we understand, and your team does a great job of this, Josh, that we understand all the different moving parts of the equation. We can come in with more specific recommendations that address those different aspects, not just the buy-sell arrangement, but also providing income needed for the family that's just simply no longer going to be there.
What if you've got somebody that's got keepers and insurance on them, and then they want to go buy some life insurance for themselves for personally? The key person, you say, is purchased by the company.
Correct.
But then they need to, on a separate note, they want to create some liquidity for the family, the surviving family. I know one of the questions they always ask is like, how much insurance is on your life already? Like, does that start to impact your ability to get insurance on your own?
That's a great point, and exactly what I was referring to in that last question, which is that they will separate those categories. Okay. So if you say, oh, yes, I have another policy that I bought 5 years ago and my family are the beneficiaries of that policy. Now, that policy is going to be taken into account when the insurance company looks at the total amount of coverage that they'll issue on your life. But if it's, the only insurance I have is this key man policy that the business owns on my life and the business is the beneficiary and therefore my family's going to receive none of it, that's as though it really doesn't even exist. And you're starting from scratch in terms of income replacement. You can, whatever number you can justify based on your income, which is extensive, by the way. A lot of times you can get up to 20 times your income, but that will be looked at completely separately than the key man coverage. And in a lot of cases we work on, they need both. And we underwrite them simultaneously for the key man coverage and the separate coverage for income replacement for their family and issue different policies for that purpose.
So we've kind of approached this a little bit when we talk about state tax issues and bringing on, well, we haven't talked about bringing on other partners yet, but let's talk about some of the other issues that arise when a company really starts to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more specifically estate tax and then also potential future partners that they're bringing on.
So there's this sort of migration, obviously, just like in the business cycle, it's the younger business. It's, you know, not a lot of cash flow, and that suddenly changes as more success begins to occur within that business. And now suddenly we have an entity that has a significant value to it. And there are issues not just with, well, how would we buy out a deceased partner? But there are issues with, well, what if I pass away and it's going to trigger a $10 million estate tax bill in my estate? Or even the other side of this that people don't think about, what if my partner passes away? And even though we have a buy-sell arrangement, what if they don't have enough money to fund their tax liability? And for some reason, they can force a sale of the company in order to generate those funds. And that sounds inconceivable, but we have seen that time and time again.
Wow.
And so that's another category that we have to add to the buy-sell coverage or key man coverage. We're probably past the income replacement stage at that point. Mm-hmm. Really, the savings are there to support the surviving family members.
Right.
But now we need to look at, okay, what is our estate tax exposure and how are we going to address that? Are we going to address it with insurance, which a lot of people will? Or are we going to start to address that by doing some estate planning from a legal perspective, shifting assets off of our balance sheet that we just don't need any longer, discounting certain values and getting them out of our estate? There's a lot of techniques that have nothing to do with insurance that business owners who've reached that sort of elevated level of success are going to need to look at that. Again, the business adds a lot of complexity to. You know, the number one thing we do in a lot of estate planning conversations is get assets off the balance sheet. Well, it's not always that easy just to take your business and get it off your balance sheet by placing it in a separate entity. Those are conversations that take place as well when we see owners who've gotten to that stage and now it's a big added risk. They don't want to liquidate their company in order to pay an estate tax liability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For whatever reason, you may disagree with this, but life insurance in particular, there's two kind of main reasons to have it. One is to create an estate that you need to help out the surviving family. And the other reason is to protect an estate from estate taxes. I mean, there's some other strategies, of course, like cash flow and asset protection and stuff like that. But I try to keep things simple in my head.
Yeah. Well, and 100% agree with you. You know, that kind of goes back to my comment back at the beginning of this, that just about every small business owner you're going to talk to has had somebody try to sell them insurance mm-hmm. for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
In our book, the two items that you just mentioned are 90% of the reason that people should utilize insurance. Yes, there's a couple of outliers there that are the other 10%, but you are spot on. Do I need to protect my family and my income that, you know, I haven't had enough time to save enough money to support them yet? Or am I going to face a seven-figure tax bill when I pass my estate on that I worked so hard to make successful, and now I'm going to lose 40% of a portion of it because that's how our estate tax system works? Mm-hmm. Those are the number one issues that we address with clients day in and day out.
All right. So hopefully if you're an owner listening to this, we've convinced you to at least start thinking about these two things, key man and buy sell agreement. We've covered like the why, like why should you consider leveraging these two topics? And then what happens next? Like, let's talk about some of the insurance policies, like specifically, like what type of policies are appropriate? Why? What do most people, clients choose, and why do they choose them? So maybe you can dig into that a little bit for us.
Yeah.
Because insurance companies love to make things confusing. They all are a little different and nuanced. That's what I love about you, Chris Duvey, is you kind of lay it all out for us and try to compare apples to apples as best as possible. So
there's no doubt about that. We still see things come across our desk that make us scratch our head sometimes, but insurance companies are always trying to come up with something that is quote unquote different than somebody else. And at the end of the day, insurance is insurance for the purposes that we're talking about, you know, taking care of your family, protecting against taxes and so forth. And there's really two broad categories of insurance coverage. One is term insurance, which I think any of your listeners would understand at this point. I'm buying insurance for a temporary period of time to cover some specific needs that I'm going to have. And after a certain period of time, I don't need that any longer. Maybe that's a 10 or 15 or 20 year time period.
Mm-hmm.
That type of coverage is also the least expensive. It requires the least amount of investment, if you will, because it's unlikely to pay off when you pass away because it's not in force when you are 85 or 90 years old. But it is in force during the years that you have the most risk. And, you know, back to the de-risk comment that you made, you know, when you first start making significant amounts of money each year and your business is really taking off, but you don't have the savings yet to go along with it, that's a significant risk. Your family has become accustomed to a certain lifestyle. Are you going to replace that or are you not? But at the end of the day, term insurance coverage will cover the vast majority of business owner needs that are out there. That's just a fact. There are always people who will try to insert what we call permanent coverage there. Permanent coverage, going back to my two categories, you have term, you have permanent. Permanent coverage is your whole life policies of the world, your universal life, your variable universal life. Permanent is really just what it sounds like. It is insurance coverage that is designed to be enforced throughout your life and to pay a death benefit off at some point in the future. It definitely has its use, but I really see only a couple of situations where we really think permanent insurance is appropriate. And that is the tax situation, which we just talked about. If you're going to face estate tax liability, it's unlikely that that is simply going to disappear in the future and you're not going to have an estate tax liability. So that's really a permanent product is more appropriate for that. And the other is business owners aren't always trying to pass their business on to the highest bidder. Sometimes they're looking to pass it on to their children. Sometimes their children are involved in the business and it's going to be a legacy business that they want to stay within the family. We can use permanent insurance on dad or mom or whoever founded this business and got it to this elevated level. We can use that insurance to help the transition to the children, i.e. for tax purposes or simply to bridge that loss of the original founder. But in many cases where it's going to stay within the family, there are some very legitimate and appropriate reasons to use permanent insurance to help with that transition.
Mm-hmm. So from a permanent insurance component, what are the determining factors of that? I mean, obviously, the insurer and their health, quality of their health, that's going to be a big one, right?
Correct.
Where I'm going with this too a little bit, Chris, is just how do interest rates, mortality tables, I know those adjusted like down with COVID. How long does it take for so the insurance world to catch up to where the current rate environment was? I know there's a big lag a bit of a lag, right? So maybe speak to that a little bit real quick.
Yeah. So, and kind of what you're getting at here is that not every insurance policy out there simply says, here's your premium and here's your death benefit. And that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
There are a lot of insurance policies that are like that, that are what we refer to as guaranteed insurance policies. The insurance company says, here's your guaranteed premium and here's your guaranteed death benefit. And there are no moving parts, but you pay an option price with that, if you will. So that type of coverage can require a good deal more investment. There are other permanent products that are predicated upon a certain level of performance. You know, if we go way out on the volatility scale, that could just be a traditional variable life contract where you are guiding the investments based upon the mutual funds that are under the hood in that product. And Josh, you and your team are giving them advice, but they're fully exposed to markets and equities and the ups and downs that go along with that. And for many people, that's not comfortable and really not appropriate if they're looking to keep it as a long-term insurance product. So to your point about interest rates, there are a lot of products out there that are predicated on bond yields. And insurance companies have their assets invested roughly about two-thirds of their investment portfolios by regulatory requirement is in fixed income. And so the yield that we have out there and whether rates are higher or lower definitely impact insurance companies. There is the lag that you mentioned. But there are products that you can access, whether we're in the environment we're in now or we're in the environment that we had 2 years ago before all this rising bond yield environment, that are appropriate and take very little risk. But you have to go in and be well educated on what risk am I taking? If I'm taking bond yield risk, how do I feel about that? If it doesn't perform as anticipated, how much will I need to invest in addition to what I thought I was going to invest in that product? And then most importantly for us, and you've seen these calculations on spreadsheets we put together, is what ultimately is the return on my investment? If I'm buying an insurance product and I'm going to invest dollars into that product, I'm doing it to get a payoff at some point in the future. Not for me, but for my estate, for my family, et cetera. So what is my ultimate rate of return going to be on that investment? And am I comfortable with that rate of return based upon the risk that's being taken in that product? Mm-hmm. That's an educational and much deeper conversation, but those are the discussions that we get into with business owners anytime we're talking about permanent products and what is most appropriate in their situation.
Where rates are today, are you seeing better pricing?
You know, really not yet. If you think about a bond portfolio, you don't just flip it over because bond yields have risen without taking a beating on walking away from your prior holdings. So,
well, most of the yields on the shorter end too.
Correct.
Like, you know, exactly. Like 1 year, you know, T-bills 1 year, 2 year, and then it starts. Yep. We got the inverted yield curve.
We've seen some carriers who have raised their crediting rate, is what we refer to it as. Mm-hmm. The crediting rate, i.e. are they going to credit 5% as you're investing in this product, or are they going to credit 3% as you're investing in the product? That matters, because if they're crediting 5% and you're paying your premium based on that, and then it drops to 4%, well, you're going to need to add to that premium. So we have seen some carriers, just a couple though, that have raised their crediting rates on their product over the last 12 to 18 months. But really, for the most part across the board, we haven't seen a lot of pricing movement. And I think some of it is what you mentioned, is a lot of it is in the short-term range, and insurance mm-hmm. companies buy long-term, a lot of long-term fixed income. And it just takes a while to turn over a portfolio. Rates would need to stay up for quite a while before they're able to see more profitability, and then they're able to pass along some of that profitability in terms of better pricing on products.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So we've talked about mitigating risk with insurance policies. What other techniques can owners use to ensure long-term success?
Anybody who's talking to business owners, and I'll say, you know, again, business owners maybe who've to reach that elevated level of success, has to be talking about estate planning techniques that have nothing to do with insurance. And it's a conversation we've had, obviously, with probably every one of the clients that you and I have worked on together. You should be doing everything else that you can do first before using insurance to provide liquidity in the event of a estate tax exposure. Mm-hmm. And those things would include just simple gifts of assets out of the estate. Those are really pretty straightforward. So that's sort of on the lower, simple end of the scale. And if you go up towards the top of the scale, it's selling assets to a defective trust and taking a discount on those assets and a note payable that is going to transfer millions of dollars out of your estate and literally save $5, $10, $20 million of estate taxes when we look forward 30 years. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously more than we can dig into in this conversation.
Yeah, that's some chewy stuff that we need more time for.
Definitely. And everybody would need to have a nap the night before so yep. that, you know, they'd be able to hang with us. But
maybe,
there are
maybe
there
shotgun are a couple Red Bulls.
that too would help. But that's a conversation, again, that we've had many times. The business owners have some actually wonderful opportunities from an estate planning perspective versus others who have been very successful, just simply made a lot of income during their life, and their assets really are investment accounts. There's nowhere near the amount of options that somebody, you know, with a $50 million net worth that is comprised mostly of investment assets versus somebody who has a $50 million net worth that is comprised greatly of business assets. Mm-hmm. There's lots of other opportunities available for those business opportunities that just don't exist for other individuals.
Right. Well, that's what I love about this business and the world that I play in, is that I'm always learning stuff. I mean, it's a lot of fun. Every single case is unique. It's different. And you're just uncovering the facts, considering the current circumstances of the client, state of the markets, the products out there, and just trying to get everything to work together in sync. And that's what makes it fun. It's never boring. So, and we're talking about, you know, a person's life work too. I mean, the blood, sweat, and tears and that goes into building and growing a company. And when you strike a level of success, preserving that for the next generation is usually pretty high on the list for people. So this is all good stuff. Absolutely. For people to know. Well, good. Well, Chris, thanks. We're kind of rolling up at the end of our little session here. Any departing thoughts, anything?
I think you covered all of them. If we have someone who's made it to the end of this session, we commend you and we look forward to working with you.
Yes, most definitely. Most definitely. Well, listen, Chris, I I really appreciate your time. I know you've got a busy schedule out there. So thanks for spending a few minutes with us here. I think people will hopefully learn a few things from this conversation and maybe start to ask some key questions about whether or not they should include key man or buy-sell agreements. Actually, the answer, it's not whether they should, they really should be. So hopefully they're convinced. So
very true. Very true. And we appreciate the invite. Thanks for asking us to join you.
Of course. Well, good. Well, Chris, well, thanks. Take care and enjoy the rest of the week. And to the guests out there that are listening, thank you for joining us. And with that, we'll leave you be. Be safe, be well. And until next time, talk soon. Thank you for tuning in to Lightning in a Bottle. It's been a pleasure bringing you today's insights from the brightest minds in business. To stay updated with relevant content, exclusive events, and our latest podcast episodes, send us a note to atxwealthpartners.com. Until next time, keep capturing the lightning of innovation and turning it into success. I'm Josh Pottinger, wishing you a productive and prosperous week ahead. And don't forget, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.